RPG Lessons Learned. When the game is over, when your players are gone, that's when lessons are learned. We're at RPGLL Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, rpglpodcast@gmail.com, and check us out online at rpglessonslearned.com. Hi, welcome to RPG Lessons Learned, the show where you can learn from our mistakes. And with me, as usual, is Tanner.
Hey, Dusty, what's good?
You know, last recording session, when you said, hi, I'm Tanner, I was like, gosh, I never say, hi, I'm Dusty.
Yeah, people don't know who you are.
People don't know who I am. I should say, hi, I'm Dusty. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing really well. I've been playing RPGs lately with somebody other than you for once for a long time.
I know. Cheater.
Scandalous. But I think I have a lot of good stuff to talk about kind of outside of the sort of explorations that me and you have done kind of outside of our sphere of play.
I'm excited to talk about this, and you've given me the barest hint of it. You referenced it in a conversation shortly before Christmas. And then you made me aware of it as we went in to record this episode. And let's go ahead and get to the juicy stuff. You're running 5e.
D&D 5e. Big OGL fan here as we...
After the OGL drama, after Wizards, you know, betrays the community, you decide to run 5e. What's going on there?
Well... one of my players who I'm very close to, we kind of talked about, we were bubbling up. We wanted to play a game and we knew that our constraints are like, we can play once or twice a month at most. And one of my players said, Tanner, I had fun doing that, but by God, I don't want to be wandering around in hexagons and interacting with whatever's in that hexagon and then moving on. I've been listening to Critical Role and I want to play D&D 5th edition. So it's what my players wanted. That's why I'm playing it.
You have to. 5e is not really a bad game.
No.
Obviously, 5e has sustained the hobby for almost a decade. Did it come out in 2014? I don't even remember.
Yeah, it did.
So 2014, nearly a decade. So it can't be a terrible game. I think it's just kind of a jack of all trades game is the biggest complaint about it. But I ran quite a lot of 5e when it first came out. So I've got nothing against that.
As have I. This will be, I think, my fourth or fifth 5e campaign that I've run in that time. So, I mean, it's a game I have all the stuff for. It's a game that it's pretty easy to teach, honestly. Like, all my players either understand it or half understand it. And you know what? It's what my players wanted. And all the best game in the world doesn't really matter if it never gets to the table, right? And 5e gets to the table.
And sometimes for dinner. It's okay to have a ham and cheese sandwich.
Yes, sir. So another thing not to underestimate is kind of the Critical Role effect. And I know that you and I have talked before how we're not like the hugest fans of Critical Role for various reasons. Not that their show is bad by any means, or they're not like bad people or anything, but like me and you are just kind of eye rolling about it a little bit. But one of my players just has really been getting into it, and she was like, yeah, this makes me want to play D&D. So like, I think that we do have to give them credit that they make people want to play role-playing games, you know, and you know, whether or not they come into that with the best expectations, if all they've heard is Critical Role and they think that's what D&D is, I think that's kind of mistaken, but it gets people wanting to sit down at the table and roll dice. And I have to respect that.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've got no issue with Critical Role. I do roll my eyes at it, but not because I think Matt or is it Marisha or Marishka? I can't remember.
Yeah.
But whatever. Matt and Sam, and I can't even name anyone else. Liam, I know that from the Matt Colville YouTube channel. No problem with them. I've seen them interviewed. I think they're very lovely people. But for me, the reason Critical Role is a miss for me, one, I'm not at a point in my life where I have 3 hours to watch video content a week.
Yep.
It's a lot of video content to commit to. One. Two, I don't watch spectator sports. I don't watch football. I don't watch basketball. I don't watch baseball. I played those things in high school, like not for, you know, JV or varsity or anything like that, but, you know, in gym class or for fun or in college. I was on intramural leagues like that. I've played. But watching it, I don't get watching it and like watching someone else's D&D session. I just don't get it. But hey, if you love it, I'm not bagging on you. Lots of people like sports, people who are smarter than me. It's just not for me. So yeah. That's why I roll my eyes at Critical Role. But no, they've done great things for the hobby.
Yep, absolutely. So yeah, that is why I'm running 5e of all games.
Fair enough. Are you doing anything to keep it fresh for yourself?
I am. And that's kind of the main thing I want to talk about in this episode. I'm trying to get away from over-preparing and relying more on tools. I'm trying to get more into campaign procedures. And I know we kind of talked about procedures last time. I was excited, but I'm happy to dig into it this time. And then I kind of want to bring like an OSR sensibility to the game, not necessarily mechanically, but like in presentation and in the things that happen in the game.
So how are you going to bring, if that person, I'm just tying this together. If your player said, I don't want to go into a hex and interact with things in that hex, but then you're also bringing an OSR sensibility, including procedures, how does that work?
Yeah. So the biggest thing that OSR stuff kind of opened my mind to is that you can create these open-ended challenges, which I define as a problem that I do not prepare a solution to, right? I'm presenting a problem or a conundrum to the players, and I'm letting them figure out how to approach it, follow the logic, and then call for, you know, roles if needed. So like for an example, in this first session we did, so far I should say I've only done a session zero and a session one. So we made our characters and kind of got the story together, and then we had our first session. In our first session, one of the missions that they picked to do was to destroy like a wooden battleship that was parked for repairs. And so that was the adventure. I'm like, your objective is to make this thing not seaworthy. Go ahead. And I didn't prepare, oh, if they talk to this person and then this person, they could smuggle gunpowder on the ship and then blow it up. Like, I created the situation, and the situation was really only about, you know, two sentences. And then I was just trying to react and improvise and adjudicate when it came to what they wanted to do. And they ended up posing as carpenters, sneaking aboard the ship, and then scouting it out, and then kind of coming back and doing essentially like a false flag operation and dressing up as mercenaries and burning it down with buckets of pitch and stuff like that. So like all of that was sort of spontaneous play that came from the players, right? That wasn't me preparing an adventure. That was me saying, this ship has this many people on it. This is what they're doing. This is what their objectives are. They're going to leave in 2 days. So it's up to the players to figure it out.
And do you figure out like an interesting fail state? Like what if they just don't? What are the consequences of like failed attempts? Is there a certain number of failed attempts where they just don't make the ship unseaworthy? Like what do you plan a failed state?
Kind of. So this kind of goes back into the procedure of the game, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But basically, my players are free to pick these missions, and they know what they're going to get from these missions. Like they will get 5 points of power for their campaign to put this person on the throne. And if they fail, they fail. And that's fine. If they escape with their lives, that's okay. But like, yeah, I'm not really planning a fail state. Like they're given the task and they can do it or not. You know what I mean?
You mentioned tools earlier. Like what kind of tools?
Yeah, so I've been really bad about over prepping in the past. And I think D&D 5e is kind of an easy game to over prepare for. Me and you have talked in the past about how for OSR games, you know, you really only need to know like a monster's hit die to kind of know everything you need to know about it, right? And I kind of try to take that approach. So I want to say we're going to be linking a lot of the tools I talk about in the show notes of this show. So if any of these sound interesting, please click on them and use them for yourself as well, because I'm finding them really nice. So the first big thing is that I'm using a Blog of Holdings monster manual on a business card. So it's literally like you figure out what the CR of a monster is, and you just you can like improvise monsters really, really easily. Like, I do not need to carry around books of monster bestiaries, really. I look at them, you know, in the session, in between sessions for inspiration, but like, you know, being able to improvise on the spot over printing out a monster stat block, or even worse, having a 350-page book open at the table referencing two different monsters flipping back and forth, like, I don't have time for that anymore.
That's fair. I love the monster manual on a business card. When I was running 5e, I made incredibly heavy use of that. Now, having said that, I firmly believe one of the best ways you can come up with adventure ideas is just reading a monster manual.
Yeah.
My favorite monster manual is the modern D20 Menace manual, or Menace something. I forget what it's called. It's my favorite one. I forget what it's called. But flipping through it, it's got a bunch of like really cool ideas where I'm like, whoa, there's an adventure right there. I think that's, though, to me, the main value of monster manuals.
Yeah, or just like reading about like this. Like, I've been looking at a lot of third-party monster manuals, and it's like, wow, this is a monster I've truly never seen before, and it has this one kind of weird, cool thematic ability. Okay, I'm just going to steal that, you know? And, like, I don't need to know that the designers gave it 52 HP versus 65 HP or something like that. Like, that's not important. And that's not what's going to be remembered at the table. You know, it's about the essence of it, and the monster manual on a business card really helps me get that essence of a monster down.
I'm going to make this a show tradition. You ready for a bad GM confession?
Yeah.
When I did run 5e and I'd find a cool monster, if it had spells, I'd be like, no, it doesn't. Because I didn't want to, at the table, flip back and forth between the monster manual and the player's handbook to find the damn spell to cast it. I would just be like, it's got fireball? Okay. That's 2d6 or 3d6.
Yep. They're changing that for 1d&D, from what I understand. They're putting all that there, which is good. I mean, that was such a step down from 4th edition, where 4e it was like, here is its encounter ability, this is exactly what it does, and it's here it is in one sentence, you know.
It was so easy to run that monster. Anyway, that was my bad GM confession.
No, it's okay. That's a good GM confession. That was a humble brag, if anything, because you're ahead of the game.
So I want to dig on the random tables. So I don't know if you're prepared for this. We can skip it if not. But like, walk me through something that you would have incorporated in an adventure that you got from a random table that you would not have otherwise incorporated. Like, how has that worked for you? For those at home who might be, frankly, Tanner, up until the last couple of years, I looked at random tables as like, I would roll my eyes and be like, what a great way to generate a bunch of stuff that does not logically make sense. But I've come around. Tell me about your use of random tables, and what have you gotten from it that you wouldn't have otherwise gotten?
Yeah, so I had a lot of fun actually putting together my GM screen for this game. I think the stock like 5e GM screen is fine if you're learning the game, but I mostly know the game, so I'm putting tools in my GM screen, you know. So there are so many good games with random tables, and I'm going to shout out a couple of them that I took to put elements of in my GM screen. Ironsworn, which is meant to be a solo or one-on-one RPG. Knave, Worlds Without Number, and the D30 Companion. So one table I really like, I don't know if this is going to come across in the camera, but there's a big table of 200 themes, and these are just like concepts. And so if I'm like, well, shit, I need to if I'm like, oh crap, I need to figure out what this adventure is, I can roll, give me a number, two numbers between 1 and 100, Dusty.
52 and 53.
Charity, and 53, Tangle. Okay, though, that's now my improv prompt for what this thing is. So okay, maybe the players need to get an item from a charitable organization that this mercenary company is coming down on, and they've been also entangled with maybe some mob bosses, and that complicates the adventure. Like, being able to just like give yourself 10 seconds to put those two things together and then do something about it is like super, super fun to me, you know? It sounds kind of like hard, but it really does get easier with practice. And Dusty was not my audience plant. He did give me two random numbers.
I love giving two consecutive random numbers when people ask me.
Yeah. I also have on this table, there's a list of missions. So these are like verbs that the players could do. And I think these are from Knave. And it's like infiltrate, protect, sabotage, follow, frame, threaten, ruin. Like those are things that I can say, okay, I'm going to say, retrieve passion. What does that mean? I don't know. But like I have to sit down for 10 seconds and like create a hook for myself. And you know, maybe it's about getting a powerful sorcerer or his passion back for magic, and you need to retrieve a magic item to do it. Like, you know, that kind of like off the cuff improv is so much more rewarding and interesting than like preparing an adventure about that. You know what I mean?
I do. All right. So you leaned over and grabbed your actual GM screen. Mm-hmm. I've got a question for you. This is what I struggle with the most. To randomly generate or to come up with on the fly. The question I hate the most when I'm GMing is, hey, what's this guy's name? Do you have a table of names?
I do. I have 200 names right here. I think I bumped the mic when I said that the first time. And nice. these are names that I didn't copy and paste these. I like literally hand wrote each one of these names in an Excel thing. So I don't think any of them are truly stupid, which is can sometimes happen when you get those name generators that are like, here's the first syllable and then the second syllable. So
I had this wonderful bookmark on my phone that was like the top 200 most popular medieval names. Mm-hmm. And that's what I would use. And you know, sometimes you lose the bookmark to like a website going down and being gone forever. I need to go on the Wayback Machine and see if I can retrieve that. But there's my sad story about names. Anyway, so it sounds like you're using these tables. We talked about procedurally generating a story in the last episode. You're kind of procedurally generating the adventure. And you mentioned procedures earlier. When you say procedure, like, for all the 5e fans out there who don't know, because there's not a lot of procedures in 5e, what is a procedure? Like, how does that work at the table for you?
So, yeah. So, I've kind of like just got turned on to this idea as an idea recently. So, I'm still very new to this and I'm probably getting things wrong. But the definition I found was on the Prismatic Wasteland blog, which I'm a fan of. And the author there writes, procedures are a type of rule that provides the order of operation for a game and works to structure play. And then an addendum, this order typically repeats. So it's kind of like, you know, your turn in Monopoly. You know, you roll the dice, you do this, you can do this or this, and then it's the next player's turn. So the theme for my game is that my players are helping a noble trying to take back a corrupt kingdom from mercenaries who rule it, right? And for this game, it involves a campaign turn. And so the campaign turn for this game, I actually have it. This is on the other side of my GM screen. This actually faces the players. So this is a player-facing mechanic, literally. Is to check the current campaign scores, assess your situation, and decide what moves you want to make next. Each player draws a decree card. I made a lot of cards for this too. So like the players, this represents like the players are advisors and these are sort of the orders they're giving to other people. So a decree might be like assassinate a mercenary official or raid a local village for supplies, things like that. And those just sort of happen. They can then make an attempt to recruit a powerful ally and then they can go on a mission after that. And that's either a mission for that ally or one of the always available missions, and then deal with a complication if one comes up. So I've been talking a lot. That's a lot to take in. Do you have anything to say about that?
No, it sounds a lot like Fate. You know, yeah. I can't remember all the four primary actions of Fate, but it sounds like the four primary actions of Fate.
Yeah. So the idea is that because I know we're only playing once a month or twice a month on a good month, I never want to leave them halfway through a dungeon. Because if you're on January 5th, you do half a dungeon, and then trying to pick that up again on February 5th, that's hard to do. So I want to make this campaign turn happen as many times as they want to during a session, right? So a lot of those missions are like one or two encounter type things, or like a very small little dungeon that can happen in an hour or something like that.
Are you doing XP leveling, or are you doing milestone leveling?
I'm doing milestone leveling for now. I thought about kind of hooking it into the like progression, but I feel like that would just be kind of math for math's sake. And to be frank, my players all really prefer milestone leveling. So I got them to like level 2 halfway through the first session. And then like at the start of our next session, they're going to be level 3, which is kind of when the game gets good, I think.
The one 5e thing that I really want to run is Neverland.
Mm-hmm.
I think that'll be my last 5e game. If I can ever get a physical group together for Neverland, that's going to be the last 5e game that I ever run. And I came up with a really novel system for leveling up that I cannot wait to spring on some unsuspecting players in person that I hope I get to do before I die.
Yeah. Well, you don't have to get all morbid about it, Dusty. It's just a game.
Fair enough.
And then one other thing too, part of the procedure that happens at the end that is secret to me is that sometimes a complication will happen, which is if the players really mess up, this is sort of like the other enemy faction will strike back against them. I've got a list of 20 complications that come up, and a lot of them is like, okay, suddenly they're like presented with a dilemma that they've got to figure out right now. Like, a popular traveling historian wants to inspect their royal regalia to sketch them and take notes for posterity. Should he be allowed to be granted access? You know, that's a risk. Like, are you going to let somebody look at the crown jewels who you don't know? It could be good because he could get the word out, but you don't know who this guy is, right? So like, I always want to throw in those dilemmas and complications, and I'm going to kind of restock this list as they go through them. But I have 20, which is going to be enough for a long time. So, but those are also like little role-playing encounter prompts, almost like random encounters, but they're all kind of negative. You know what I mean?
I do.
They're all dangerous. Yeah.
Can I challenge you?
Yeah.
I challenge you not to restock it, because how are you going to work it in if they roll again that, hey, another historian shows up and wants to sketch your goods? Like, oh shit, was the previous one an imposter? Is the same guy like following them because he found them interesting? Like, there's got to be a fun way to play rolling the same prompt twice.
Yeah, you're right. The one that they got last time was that an enemy spy was captured and they weren't giving up what they were spying about. And one of the other counselors suggested to have them released and then follow them for more intel, or he might just disappear, right? Or they could just kill him now. But they chose to release him and see where he goes, and they immediately lost track of him. So they just let a spy walk out. So that would be a fun one to roll again and be like, yeah, another spy shows up. What are you going to do this time? And I know my players are going to be like, we're getting rid of this guy. So that could be a fun moment. You're right. Maybe I should not restock them. I'm going to mark the ones that I've done. But yeah, if I get them again, I think that'd be funny.
So how has this gone so far?
It's gone pretty well. So we've had one session so far, like I've said, a session 0 and then a session 1, but like it seems pretty promising. Like, I'm excited to run this. Like, this procedure based play like really has kind of gotten me excited to run, rather than dreading being like, oh, what's the adventure I'm gonna make next session? I don't know what the adventure is. Like, I'm gonna improvise it. And I've told my players, I'm like, hey, I'm trying something new with this game, so give me some grace. I might need to like take a 15-minute break once or twice a session to like figure out what's happening next. And they were all cool with it, you know? So like, I have the buy-in from the players about this. And honestly, the players are just kind of like happy to be at the table and goofing around with each other and playing games. It's been fun.
That's awesome, man.
Yeah.
I've been playing in person as well, also not with you, in Martin's game with Martin and his brother. And I've made reference to that game quite a few times over the years. And we're playing OSE now, Old School Essentials. But yeah, there's just something magical that happens. Like, I really enjoy our games that we play over the internet, over Google Meets. But there's something magical that happens at the table in person. So I'm really happy for you that's back in your life.
Yeah, me too. And there was a long time where I didn't know if it was ever going to be back in my life. And that really kind of existentially bummed me out because this hobby has been such a huge part of my life, you know? So yeah, I'm glad it's going. Hopefully it keeps going. Maybe if something else pertinent comes up, maybe I'll give you guys an update on how it's going. If like I have a particularly interesting session or something to talk about. But yeah, man, I'm just excited. And I hope that this approach kind of like, it's like I'm training a new muscle a little bit. Not that I train any of my muscles in real life, but in RPG world, like it's training a new muscle to get away from over preparing and into the world of improvising and reacting and having tools for yourself. So I'm excited.
I'm looking forward to hearing more about it personally, as well as potentially on the show. All right. So you take it away with lessons learned, like as you revisit 5e after presumably many years away, like what lessons have you learned? Take it away.
So lesson learned number one, you got to make a system work for you, not against you. I unfortunately had enough time in my life to identify the pain points of 5e, and I'm trying to circumvent those, right? I'm using the tools like the monster manual and the business card and all these other tables to try to get me to where I find the game to be fun, and like lugging around 300 page books is not fun. So that's lesson learned number one for me. Lesson learned number two, kind of related, you know, make a toolbox for the game that you want to run. If you find yourself having to do the same types of things over and over again, you could probably make a tool for yourself that will make life easier, you know. Instead of reaching for the wrong tool, you know, like it can be as simple as like, if you have to reference the grappling rules every other session, just put that on a note card and put it in your GM screen. You know what I mean? Like that, it can be as simple as that. Lesson learned number three, an oldie but a goodie. Me and you have been beating this drum for a long time, but knowing other systems makes any game you run better. Right?
You know, one of my favorite movies is Ghost Dog, starring Forest Whitaker. I'm going to mess up Jim's last name, but Jim Jarmusch, I believe, is the writer-director. Love that movie. And there's all these quotes from the Hagakure scattered throughout. And one of my favorite, I'm going to butcher it, is roughly, you know, a samurai can hear about other people's ways and become more and more in accord with his own. So I think that's the variety of learning about lots of different things, different game styles, different mechanics, different milieus, different ideas, different everything. It just makes what you enjoy doing richer and richer and richer.
Yeah, because you're going to take all the parts of it that you love, and you're going to forget about the parts of that you don't love or don't inspire you, you know, and you're going to make whatever you make better. And then lesson learned number four, bonus lesson learned. Sometimes you got to run the kind of game your players want to play. You know, as much as I would love every single one of my games to be set in a little magical hexagon where they encounter some weird, dumb NPC that confuses them and then they move on. Like, that's my platonic ideal of games. But you know what? If the players don't want to play it, you know, the best games that are the ones that happen, right? And like, say what you want about 5e, say what you want about people's taste, but if that's what they want to play and you can get together and have a good time, that's what you should do.
And I've seen some really entitled GM takes trying to rebut that, like to find new players. But you know what? Here's how I'm going to restate your lesson learned. If I really want to watch a movie with my wife, I don't always get to pick the movie.
Yep. Yeah. Sometimes you got to go with the flow. When you go out with your friends, sometimes they don't go to the bar that you like or your favorite restaurant. You know what? That's why you got to find a side piece like Dusty who will play all the weird games with you so that you can go play 5e with everybody else.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thank you for listening.
Take care.
People call them postmortems, evaluations, appraisals, reviews, retrospectives. We call them lessons learned. And we're sharing ours with you.